Today on the program, a bond market primer. Trust me, it's the story you didn't know you needed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 21st day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Much is yet to be written, said, and done about the current banking agita in this economy. But at the root of it, the bank runs, the collapses, the potential reworking of how bank insurance works. Let us not forget the politicking of it, too. At root is one seemingly simple economic reality. When interest rates go up, bond values go down. And that's what got a bunch of these banks into trouble. But why? What does the Fed raising rates have to do with the value of bonds sitting in bank vaults? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Okay, so let's say you buy a bond.
Hi, bond.
And, you know, it's a bond, so it gives you payments. They're called coupons.
I love you, bond, because you give me money.
So you pay like $1,000 for a 10-year bond. You get paid 5%.
5%.
And these payments are locked in, okay? They're part of the bond. No matter what, you get like $50 a year.
$50.
But then something happens. The Fed raises interest rates, and that pushes up interest rates all over the economy.
The whole economy.
Including for new bonds, bonds printed just today.
Wait, bonds? What?
And let's say these new bonds give you 10% now, $100 a year. How do you feel about that old bond giving you just 5%?
It's not going to work out. It's not you. It is you. I just found someone better, better.
So you'd rather have a better bond.
So I'm going to actually sell you.
But here is the problem.
So the price of a bond, like any other asset, is determined by what other people are willing to pay for it.
Eric Winograd is U.S. economist at Alliance Bernstein. You might have paid $1,000 to get $50 a year, but who's going to give you what you paid for it when there are better alternatives? Nobody. That's who.
So the price of your 5% bond has to go down.
Steve Lipley co-heads bond ETFs for BlackRock. Now, your bond is still going to crank out those $50 payments every year, come hell or high water.
Cash flows can't change, but the price can.
If someone buys your bond for less than its original value, yeah, you are going to take a loss. That's what happened to the banks that were forced to sell to cover withdrawals. But for the buyer, it is just as if the bond had a higher return for them. They buy it for half price, but they're still getting the same $50 payouts. So for them, the return is just as good as a new bond. So that is why bond prices fall when interest rates go up. When interest rates rise on new bonds, the older, lower-yield bonds have to compensate by getting cheaper.
And that's what we saw throughout all of last year.
Marvin Lowe is a senior strategist at State Street Global Markets.
Bond prices went down as interest rates were rising.
And that is where the banks got in trouble. They had invested in bonds, the value went down, some of them hadn't covered their risk as banks usually do, and we got the mess we are in. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, ordinarily the day ahead of a Fed interest rate announcement, you would see a little hesitation, not much movement either direction on the major indices. Today was not that day. I'm sorry, I'm still smiling over Sabri's piece. We will have the details when we do the numbers. So here's something. The National Association of Realtors released some data this morning that shows the median price of existing homes was down 0.2% last month over the same time a year ago. Down. Home prices. That's the first 12-month decline since February of 2012. Meanwhile, something called the CoreLogic Single Family Rent Index shows rent growth, and that's important, rent growth slowed for the 9th straight month. That is overall, to be clear, because there is one category of renter where price increases are somewhat stickier. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab looks at why lower price renters are more likely to see their rent increases continue to climb.
Demand has always outpaced supply in Florida's housing market, especially for renters in the lower price tier. But Ashawn Nesbitt, CEO of the Florida Housing Coalition, says recently it's gotten worse.
The instability is reaching a much wider portion of the population.
Florida is the fastest growing state, according to the Census Bureau, partly thanks to people moving there during the pandemic. Yes, that includes high-earning tech workers who put pressure on both the sales and rental markets. But Nesbitt says a lot of hourly workers are flocking to the region's growing tourism and service industries. That's made the affordability problem at the low end worse.
And that can be said of every market in Florida.
Price growth is slowing for renters overall. It's at around 6%, half of what it was a year ago. Meanwhile, it's stuck at 8.5% for lower-priced renters. Molly Basil, an economist at CoreLogic, says that's partly because there are more renters in that housing tier.
And so you have a lot of renters demanding those and not a lot of inventory at that end of the market.
Everything from zoning laws to labor shortages has kept builders focused on more expensive homes. Meanwhile, high market renters and even some middle ones got a break in 2020. Whitney Ergood-Obricki at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies says those rents dropped and landlords offered incentives for new renters.
In the meantime, the middle and lower quality apartments just continued a steady rise.
Ergood-Obricki says these renters are the only ones that didn't get a break during the pandemic. I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
In March of 2020, tens of millions of people in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP in the vernacular, started getting extra allotments every month because of the pandemic. Over time, as states ended their pandemic emergencies, people in those states stopped getting that extra food money. 32 states, though, had kept the extra benefit in place until this month, and that means that everybody on SNAP is now getting at least $95 less a month to spend on food. Some have had much deeper cuts than that, we should say. Marketplace's Samantha Fields talked to one mother about what this will mean, even as food inflation this year is still figured to hit 8%.
Hello.
The first thing Mansi Meikle points out to me when I walk into her bright, airy apartment is that the green plastic shelf that holds her kids' snacks is almost empty.
My daughter this morning, she was like, "Mom, you need to buy more snacks. There's no snacks over here." I'm like, "You don't say."
Meikle is a single mom in Queens, New York, with three kids, 4, 6, and 9. And she says they're hungry all the time.
Like every 15 minutes, I kid you not. Like if I don't tell them no, like they will literally eat that whole container of snacks in literally one day.
It's not just the snacks that are running low. She's also down to 2 eggs. Meikle had been hoping to hold out for another few days before going to the grocery store because her February SNAP benefits have already run out.
Now I really have to go spend actual money on food.
She's only able to work part-time these days because she doesn't have anyone else to take care of her kids after school. And she's also in school herself, working on her associate's degree. Right now, she's only making about $800 a month as a home health aide. With the increase in SNAP benefits these last 3 years, she's been getting more than that every month in food stamps.
It made such a huge difference. Like, especially with the prices of food and everything going up, you're like, yes, this is so beneficial. This is really good.
But with her benefits being cut by about $120 a month.
Now you have to really go back to the drawing table. Like, how are we going to bridge that gap?
After school, Meikle picks the kids up and they head to the grocery store.
Mommy, chocolate.
Her daughter, the 4-year-old, insists on pushing the shopping cart.
Unlicensed driver.
And she immediately grabs a box of cherry tomatoes and tosses them in. Meikle takes them out and puts them back.
I bought tomatoes earlier. Let's get some cheese.
The boys have run off to look for snacks. For the last few years, the extra SNAP benefits have given Meikle the ability to treat her kids to their favorite foods a little more often.
Yeah. They get their own milk and they're like, you know, the little Nesquik. When they give me the food, they'll be like, "Can we have our own milk?" I'm like, "Of course."
Now she's going to have to start saying no again more often.
While you might understand that, hey, you know, the funds are not there to get the stuff. Kids are more like, yeah, but we used to have it, and now we don't.
No, Zeffy. Nope.
Take it out. No, you.
For the most part, Meikle says, the kids are actually really good about listening when she says no at the store.
Once I just explain to them, like, you know, we are literally poor. I literally tell them, like, we don't really have it.
And they get it, she says, but it's still tough.
Okay, I'm done. Register. Go.
No.
That's it. Come on. Hi, how you doing? I'm good.
A couple of boxes of chips, a bottle of juice, tortillas, ground beef, and cheese somehow adds up to almost $50.
$49.30.
And this food will only last them a couple of days at most. As soon as they get home, the kids start asking for snacks.
I want some juice pouch. Here you go.
You guys, homework.
Mikkel starts right in on dinner, chopping lettuce and tomatoes, cooking up ground beef.
Does anybody want the hard taco shells or just the soft ones?
Mikkel is trying not to worry too much about what she's going to do with $120 less in SNAP benefits now a month.
Now I have to spend money, you know, money that I don't have on actual food because I can't let them go without. Well, I could go without certain stuff. It's like, I don't want to be hungry and hearing, Mom, Mom, but we don't have any snacks. We don't have any juice. We don't have any cereal.
She'd rather be hungry herself, she says, and know that her kids have enough.
And I just want cheese. I just want cheese.
I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
it's just peanut powder put into capsules.
All for the low, low price of $2.5 billion. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 316 today, almost 1%, closed at 32,560. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained 184 points. That is just shy of 1.6%, 11,860. The S&P 500 gained 51 points, 1.3%, 4,002. Bank stocks closed mostly higher today. That's after Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen suggested the Biden administration wouldn't be shy about trying to protect small lenders. Citigroup gained 2.2% today. PNC Financial Services jumped 3.3%. U.S. Bancorp up 8.9% today. I feel like we ought to get some Bree back for this one just to do that voice thing. But bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.60%. If I had any guts, I'd do it here right now. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is a lot going on in this economy right now, a lot of it happening very, very quickly. So we thought this would be a good time to get Kyla Scanlon back on the phone. We had her on last fall talking about how she does what she does, educating people about this economy on TikTok and YouTube, in her newsletter, pretty much all the socials. Kyla, it's good to have you back.
Very excited to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Very different circumstances, though. Last time it was all inflation and how you got people to pay attention to that. Now it seems there's a sort of a different vibe in the air. Yes?
Absolutely. Yeah, very much a different vibe.
So look, how does that affect? So we should say here, and I said it in the introduction, you are, I think, you really try to educate people about this economy, right? That's your thing.
Yeah, I try my best, for sure.
And you do a great job, and we talked about that last time. Here's what I want to know before we get into the substance. How has the change in the economic situation changed the way you do what you do?
Mm. Yeah, I try to be gentler, right? So I think things are a lot scary. It's a lot bigger, and you have to be very cautious in the word choices that you use, the facial expressions that you make, because when people are watching your videos every day, they can notice small discrepancies.
It's so interesting you concentrate on your facial expressions because, of course, on TikTok and Instagram, it's all visual and you are right out there.
Yeah.
So to the nuts and bolts, what do you make of this moment that we're in?
What part of it?
Okay, all right. Well, let's go big and small. First of all, the whole thing, right? We got the Fed coming up tomorrow. Right. We have a banking situation. I will let you call it a crisis if you want. We've still got inflation. What are you thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it's super tough, but I think the Fed has a really tough decision tomorrow. You know, like they've raised rates to the point where a little banking situation was caused and we still have inflation. So I think that's either showing the limits of the Fed toolkit, showing that fiscal policy probably needs to step up, and then also showing that maybe the Fed went a little bit too hard in the paint with raising rates for a while. Yeah.
Jay Powell in the paint. Yeah, I can see that. Sorry, I want to get back to you for a minute and how you do what you do. You know, one of my mantras all the years doing this job is look, if you don't understand the economy, it will one day rear up and bite you in the tuchus. And and sadly, I have been proven right many a time. I wonder how you, as you try to reach your audience, which we talked about last time, right? Mm-hmm. How you make them understand that?
Like that they need to understand
that
the economy?
That they need to know. You need to know this or it will hurt you. Yeah.
So I think number one, people do want to understand, but they don't even know where to start. And then number two, people who don't want to talk about the economy, they're more often doing it because like it's big and scary and it's a big, scary thing to understand. And so for me, like when I try to explain stuff, I try to use words like vibes, right? To be right. Things like sentiment, you know, using the characters and the skits really helps convey like how people should feel about stuff. Like if you see a character make a face or based on that script, people do want to understand and we just have to give them the toolkit.
We should say here, and we should give out the handle, right? It's at Kyla Scan, right? On virtually every platform you're out there. And I personally recommend the TikToks and the Instas. Let me get you back to the vibe, though, right? Last time we had you on, we talked about the vibe session and how you had coined that term and it was getting all kinds of pickup. And people were basically like, yeah, that's exactly right. You now have a thing called the take economy. Explain that.
Oh. It's sort of funny. Credit Suisse cited this too. They were like, Twitter is the reason that our bank blew up.
Right.
And same with Silicon Valley Bank. Like you had social media risk, which is a risk that nobody's really sure how to price. Nobody's really sure how to evaluate the power of Twitter.com and causing a bank run. But I feel like there's these incentives in place for different types of people to really incite rage and fear into the hearts of many in order to like get a bag, right? It's just very valuable to be very loud, even if you're wrong, which is unfortunate.
It is indeed. What now happens, do you suppose, once we're through this tough spot, right? I mean, we're going to get through Powell tomorrow. We'll have another banking thing happen, or maybe not. Jamie Dimon's going to save the world, or maybe not. And then what?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting with Jamie Dimon, J.P. Morgan, like it's literally just like the panics of, you know, 1907.
History matters. I say that all the time. History matters. Y'all can look it up.
I mean, I think there will be more regulation in place for sure. I think that we've seen a lot of unprecedented action from policymakers on this, like the Treasury, the FDIC, the Fed all getting together, making this big decision, all the central banks coordinating so we could do swap lines, all the big banks coordinating so they could save First Republic. Like we've seen a lot of collective action. And I'd be curious to see how that transfers over into the future. Like how are these all these entities going to work together moving forward?
I cannot recommend her content highly enough. Her name is Kyla Scanlon. You can get her at Kyla Scan on every platform that's out there. Sign up. Get her stuff.
Really appreciate
Kyla,
it.
Yeah. Thanks a bunch.
Woo. Thank you. Appreciate it.
One of the most amazing things about the last couple of years in this economy is the sheer doggedness of the American consumer. We have just kept on spending right through rising prices and rising interest rates. But there are starting to be some signs that we are maybe thinking twice. The polling firm Ipsos released its March Global Consumer Confidence Index this week, from which we learned consumer expectations for where the economy might be headed have been shaken up a bit. Marketplaces of NMR looked into what happens if those expectations get shaken a little bit more.
In terms of routine spending, people seem pretty unbothered by turmoil in the banking sector, according to Chris Jackson with Ipsos.
For the average American consumer, something like the failure of a bank that primarily services tech startups isn't something that actually has a direct impact on their day-to-day life.
Or on, say, their grocery budget.
Not like gas prices going up a quarter or a dollar.
But headlines about SVB's collapse do have many of us bracing for future economic trouble.
And when people worry, they keep the money in the bank account just in case they need it for bad times ahead.
Wendy Edelberg, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says those savings will be diverted away from any big discretionary purchases we might have been planning.
If recent events cause people to say, buy fewer cars, do fewer renovations in their homes, take a little bit less travel because they're worried.
Then Edelberg says that softening of consumer demand could help tame inflation and maybe get us closer to that soft landing the Fed has been after. Consumers haven't yet seen a reason to rein in their day-to-day spending, says Ravi Dhar, who directs Yale's Center for Consumer Insights.
As long as you have a job, as long as you're getting some benefits, I think your own condition is not affected, and that often does not impact your short-term spending.
But as for big ticket purchases, Dhar expects consumers to hold on to their wallets and take a wait and see attitude. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Nestle brings to mind Crunch Bars, Nespresso maybe, Haagen-Dazs ice cream, they own that too, various bottled water brands. Mark Schneider, though, the CEO of that company, when he thinks Nestle, he thinks pharmaceuticals, more specifically the intersection of nutrition and pharma. So 2 years ago, Nestle spent $2.5 billion to buy the company that came up with the first ever FDA-approved medication for peanut allergies. Dasha Afanasieva is a consumer goods reporter for Bloomberg in London, where she wrote about Nestle's acquisition of the peanut allergy treatment Palforzia and the peril therein. Dasha, thanks for being here.
It's good to be on. Thank you.
People think of Nestle, as I said in the introduction, they do not think pharmaceuticals. How did it come to pass that Nestle spent $2.5 billion on a pharmaceutical company that makes very specifically this medicine we're talking about?
Yeah, you're right. Historically, Nestle is known for things like candy bars and infant formula, but it was looking for new avenues of growth and decided that sort of this crossover between nutrition and health and pharma was where it wanted to be and it would be a high growth area. So it invested in this drug and it didn't go very well.
No, it didn't at all, which is why we're talking to you. First of all, explain how this drug works, because, you know, millions of people have peanut allergies. It's a big deal for children. Explain how this thing works that would make it such a promising investment for Nestle.
So it sounded like a promising investment because it was FDA approved. But in reality, it's just peanut powder put into capsules. And it's measured very, very precisely. You can give your child a little bit of this peanut powder, see how they do, and gradually work them up so peanuts aren't really as dangerous for them.
It is, though, really high touch, right? I mean, it involves a lot of effort on the part of the would-be consumer to make this medicine, Palforzia, effective.
That's right. So it happens over 2 years and it involves lots of visits to the doctor's surgery, lots of monitoring. If you're the child, there's lots of things you can't do around the time when you take this treatment because you kind of have to keep your body temperature the same. So you're not supposed to exercise, you're not supposed to take hot showers. So it's a very big commitment for both the child and the parents.
Yeah. Nestle has, since your initial article came out and since this drug has not caught on, Nestle has said they're going to sell it off. They're going to write it down to the tune of something like $2 billion. One wonders whether Mark Schneider, the CEO of Nestle, in trying to move the company, maybe kind of didn't read the room on this particular investment.
Yeah, it's a funny one because he also used to be the CEO of a pharma company. Right. So if anyone should know. And, you know, since they've formally launched the sales process, but as you said, they've taken a big write down. Hmm. I think that they're still super interested in stuff that intersects where it's, you know, health and nutrition and that sort of stuff. But pharmaceuticals is not going to be something that Nestle invests in again, I think. You know, apart from this misstep, I think you also have to appreciate that the path to market is very different. You know, marketing to doctors and then indirectly patients is different to selling to supermarkets.
Yeah. Right. Well, let's talk about that marketing thing for a second, right? Because it's a totally different ballgame marketing, you know, Nespresso with George Clooney, which Nestle owns, versus a really expensive pharmaceutical.
It's super different because, you know, with Nespresso, it's similar in that you might be convincing somebody that they need a product, but the people you're convincing are completely different. Right. And, you know, regulators are different in different countries. You have all these different bodies you have to convince of both, you know, the efficacy and the cost effectiveness of something. And then all of that has to sort of percolate through to the end consumer and their parents, crucially. Right. So right. It's completely different to selling Kit Kats or Nespresso.
Right. Dasha Afanasyeva, she's a consumer goods reporter at Bloomberg News. We got her in London. Dasha, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
This final note on the way out today, a little reading between the lines on that speech that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen gave this morning, the one where she said of the bailout of SVB depositors, and this is a quote, similar actions could be warranted if smaller institutions suffer deposit runs that pose the risk of contagion. Well, so far, so good. But then in the Q&A after the speech, she was asked what exactly those actions could be. And she said, quoting again, I don't want to speculate at this point on what those adjustments might be. What I'm focused on, she went on, is stabilizing our system and restoring the confidence of depositors. Confidence in banking is the whole ballgame. All right, we got to go. A very quick moment of economic context, though. It's really a calendar update, actually. The first Senate Banking Committee hearing on SVB et al., next Tuesday, the first of several hearings, said Chairman Sherrod Brown. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Ellen Rolfes, Virginia K. Smith, and Tony Wagner. Francesca Levy is the Executive Director of Digital and On-Demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.